also be exempted from the knock-and-announce requirement if they believe that a knock-and-announcement would allow the suspect to destroy evidence. The courts have since held that police may enter at the scene of a search without announcing, even with a regular warrant, if they hear or see activity inside the residence that merely suggests someone is destroying evidence. Brennan thoroughly rebuts all of those assumptions in his dissent. Though the principles he defends are backed by centuries of Anglo-American common law, his Kerr opinion was one of the last times someone as prominent as a Supreme Court justice would articulate them. His first point is that to allow an exception for the possible destruction of evidence or out of fear for the safety of police officers is to do obvious violence to the presumption of innocence. In fact, Brennan writes, allowing for those exceptions violates the presumption of innocence twice. First, by assuming the suspect is guilty of the crime for which he is suspected, and second, by assuming he will attempt to escape, violently confront the police, or attempt to destroy evidence if the police are required to announce themselves. Second, Brennan points out that to allow police to enter a home because they hear loud noises or running is to allow them to forcibly enter a home without announcement based on conduct that not only isn't criminal, but is ambiguous. Since the police wouldn't be permitted to prosecute someone for obstruction of justice based only on such sounds, so Brennan objected to the idea that the same sounds could be enough to allow police to enter a home without announcing. But even accepting an exception that allows the police to enter unannounced if they hear or see activity suggesting that the suspect is destroying evidence, there was no evidence of such activity in the Kerr trial record. The exception is based only on the officer's testimony that narcotics suspects often attempt to destroy evidence when they realize the police are at the door. This, Brennan notes, was enough to create an exception to the knock-and-announce rule for any narcotics search, indeed any search related to a crime involving evidence that can be easily and quickly destroyed. The recognition of exceptions to great principles always creates, of course, the hazard that the exceptions will devour the rule, Brennan writes. Brennan also touches on a number of practical problems with the repercussions of the ruling. He points out the problem of mistaken identity in criminal investigations, warning that innocent citizens should not suffer the shock, fright, or embarrassment attendant upon an unannounced police intrusion. That was a glimpse of the hundreds of wrong-door raids that would go down in the years to come. Brennan also points out the explicit danger that unannounced entries pose to police, writing that one common law reason for the announcement requirement was to protect the arresting officers from being shot as trespassers. Here, too, he would be proven correct in the coming decades. Dozens of police officers would be shot, maimed, and killed during unannounced raids, often by citizens who could plausibly claim that they thought they were firing at criminal intruders. Those tragedies transpired because, in the coming decades, the court would adopt Clark's reading of the exceptions into statutes that didn't mention them, and eventually into the Fourth Amendment itself. The exceptions would be expanded to the point where, perversely, the court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment in regard to the knock-and-announce rule would put more emphasis on preserving evidence and protecting law enforcement than on the Castle Doctrine and protecting the home from violence. Interestingly, it's far from clear that a majority of the justices in Kerr actually backed Clark's interpretation of the Castle Doctrine. Although the vote was 5-4 in favor of upholding Kerr's conviction, Justice John Harlan II voted with the majority only in the outcome. Harlan didn't agree with incorporating the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness requirement to the states. Instead, he thought the California law under which the Kerrs were convicted should be evaluated under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which he described as more flexible than the Fourth Amendment standard applied to federal law enforcement. Harlan didn't expressly write that the Kerr search violated the Fourth Amendment. If that was indeed what he believed, then a majority of justices believed that, had the Kerr search been carried out by federal agents, it would have been unconstitutional. And a majority had already indicated that the Fourth Amendment should be incorporated to the states. That would seem to suggest that there's at least a chance that the decision in Kerr while bad for the Kerrs, actually narrowly upheld the Castle Doctrine protections in Miller. But that isn't the way the decision was interpreted. When lawmakers, academics, and the media discussed and debated the knock-and-announce rule over the next 20 years, Kerr would be referenced as accepted law, even by civil liberties advocates. A year after Kerr, in 1964, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller pushed two laws that would give police in the state sweeping new powers, the No-Knock Bill and the Stop-and-Frisk Bill. 9 years later, he would push through some of the most draconian anti-drug laws in the country, collectively known as the Rockefeller Drug Laws. The No-Knock Bill allowed police to get a special search warrant authorizing them to ignore the knock-and-announce requirement, so long as a state judge agreed that one of the exigent circumstances that Justice Clark laid out in Kerr was present. The Stop-and-Frisk Bill allowed police to stop, detain, and pat down anyone in a public space whom they found suspicious. The No-Knock Bill passed with overwhelming support from the New York Assembly and State Senate. The Stop-and-Frisk Bill passed by narrower margins. There was at least some opposition. Civil rights groups like the NAACP and the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, held rallies in protest of both bills. The Association of the Bar of the City of New York protested the Stop-and-Frisk Bill, but supported the no-knock searches. The New York State Bar Association opposed both and argued that the No-Knock Bill flies in the face of a long-established policy that a man's home is his castle, and for the state to invade it, it must strictly comply with safeguards which have been found to be important over the years. Rockefeller and other supporters emphasized that officers still had to get a warrant. A judge had to be first satisfied by proof under oath that notice will endanger the safety of the officer or another person, or that the evidence may be readily destroyed. The Bar Association answered that experience has shown that the supposed safeguard of a special oath to the magistrate issuing the warrant would speedily become a boilerplate routine. That, too, was a concern that Brennan had expressed in Kerr. As we'll see, both Brennan and the New York State Bar Association would be proven correct. In the short term, Rockefeller's no-knock law had surprisingly little impact. The New York Times later reported in 1970 that while the law scored points with the law-abiding public, it had almost no impact on how warrants were served in the state. The paper reported that in a recent year since the law had been passed, the precise year wasn't specified, the New York State Police used the law only 12 times in 1,847 narcotics cases. There were probably more no-knock raids than that. A cop could still decide at the scene that exigent circumstances had materialized after he had obtained a regular search warrant. It would then be up to a court to decide if that assessment had been correct. Nevertheless, there was little indication that the police even wanted the law, and the fact that they used it so little after it was passed suggests that it was more of a political statement than an essential law enforcement tool. Police departments in New York didn't even appear to find this tool useful, much less essential. Perhaps they found the tactic unnecessarily invasive and aggressive. Perhaps they feared that barreling into a home unannounced was more likely to invite violent retaliation than prevent it. But the law didn't come with any accompanying public or political cries for New York cops to get more aggressive and confrontational with suspected drug offenders. Richard Bartlett, one of the bill's sponsors in the legislature, was serving on a state penal law commission at the time. The commission was charged with interviewing law enforcement officials, criminologists, and other experts, then recommending laws to improve the state's criminal justice system. Bartlett says that the no-knock law was not the product of his commission's research. It was just something one of these groups, I think it was the District Attorneys Association, came up with that picked up political momentum. But it wasn't anything we studied on the commission. If the police seldom used the no-knock law after it passed, that may have been because crime wasn't yet the demagogic issue it would soon become. Rockefeller's push for the laws didn't come with the war imagery and apocalyptic rhetoric that would soon emanate from Nixon and the cadre of crime-fighting Republicans elected to Congress several years later. The most lasting effect of the Rockefellers' push in 1964 was to legitimize no-knock raids. Prior to the law, police only occasionally raided a residence without an announcement. Sometimes they got away with it, sometimes they didn't. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the first public appearance of the phrase no-knock raid came in 1964. That's also the first time the phrase appears in the archive of the New York Times. Rockefeller made the no-knock raid a policy, and he gave it a name. No longer merely a decision that cops sometimes make in the heat of the moment, it was now a tactic and an issue. It was something that everyone was either for or against. In the summer of 1965, Los Angeles endured a suffocating heat wave. Few in the city had air conditioning, particularly in the poorer neighborhoods, so the heat collected in homes during the day, sending residents outside in the evenings in search of a breeze. California Highway Patrol officer Lee Manikas was headed north on Avalon Boulevard in the Watts neighborhood on his motorcycle on an August evening that summer when a motorist pulled up beside him to indicate that the 1955 Buick Special ahead had been weaving and the driver might be intoxicated. Manikas pulled over the driver, 21-year-old Marquette Fry. After discovering that Fry had no driver's license, Manikas asked him to perform a sobriety test. Fry put on a bit of shtick, and the two men exchanged jokes and banter. Amused passers-by stopped and began to accumulate. Manikas called to have Fry's car impounded, and Fry appeared ready to comply with his imminent arrest. But when Fry's mother, Rena Fry, arrived at the scene, the tenor of the arrest changed. Fry's mother excoriated him in front of the growing crowd. Fry grew embarrassed, then angry. When Manikas tried to put him into the car, he resisted. When another officer, who had arrived, swung to hit Fry in the arm with his baton, Fry ducked, and it struck him in the eye. Ronald Fry, Marquette Fry's brother, then punched Manikas in the kidney, and Rena Fry jumped on his back. More Los Angeles police officers arrived. After more scuffling, all three members of the Fry family were arrested. The crowd turned angry. As the police put the Fries into the backs of squad cars, a member of the crowd allegedly spit on one of the police officers. She, too, was arrested. According to the police, she, too, resisted. That only further angered the crowd. As they drove away, Marquette Fry would later say, a friend of his, who had joined the crowd, shouted to him, "Don't worry, we're going to burn this mother down." Watts burned for 6 days. The riots were different from the unrest that had broken out on the East Coast in the previous year. For one thing, while Watts could be a rough neighborhood and had some poor areas, it wasn't the sort of cramped, crushingly poor ghettos found on the East Coast. Though Watts itself was quite small, about 1 square mile at the time, the riots spread well beyond its boundaries, eventually covering 46 square miles. And where previous riots had tended to erupt and then persist in fairly concentrated areas, the Watts rioters were dispersed, random, and disorganized. Once Watts exploded on the night of August 11, 1965, the next 5 nights were a series of quick flashes and slow burns. Violence would die down in parts of the city, only to flare back up in others. Snipers took positions in elevated windows, then tried to pick off cops, firemen, and pedestrians. Looting and arson were rampant. Yet unlike many previous racial riots, no U.S. military troops were sent to Watts. Instead, on the third night, the state dispatched 13,500 California National Guard troops, who remained under the command of the Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, for the duration of the rioting. Fry's arrest was, of course, only the precipitating incident. The riots were the culmination of years of animosity between black Angelenos and the LAPD administration of Chief William Parker. Black rioters took aim mostly at white cops, motorists, and firemen. Looting was directed mostly at white-owned businesses. Parker didn't help the situation when he compared the rioters to monkeys in a zoo. By the time they finally died down, the Watts riots ranked among the most destructive in American history. The rioters caused $40 million in losses, damaged or destroyed 1,000 buildings, and left more than 1,000 injured and 34 dead. At least 4,000 people were arrested. In a couple of ways, the Watts riots were the first major incident to nudge the United States toward more militaristic policing. First, Watts made middle America begin to fear crime as never before. Much of white middle-class America spent 5 nights watching their TVs as black people looted and burned their own neighborhoods. To them, Watts and the riots in Baltimore, Newark, Washington, and Detroit in the following years were signs of a rising criminal class that was increasingly out of control. The political clout of what Nixon would, a few years later, call the silent majority would influence a generation of crime policy geared toward giving police more power, more authority, and permission to use more force. But Watts also had a more direct consequence. The LAPD's point man during the riots was 39-year-old Inspector Daryl Gates, who had been ascending the ranks of the LAPD like a Gemini pilot. The riots left Gates feeling that police training and tactics at the time were inadequate to address the sort of threat posed by the snipers, rioting, and violence he witnessed in Watts. "We had no idea how to deal with this," Gates writes in his autobiography. "We were constantly ducking bottles, rocks, knives, and Molotov cocktails. Guns were pointed out of second-story windows, random shots fired. It was random chaos in small, disparate patches. We did not know how to handle guerrilla warfare. Rather than a single mob, we had people attacking from all directions." At the time, the U.S. military's foe in Vietnam was using real guerrilla warfare. So Gates thought to ask the military for guidance. There, he found not only the tactics and training he thought could help put down the next wave of rioting, but also the inklings of what would become his most enduring legacy. Gates would create a phenomenon that, over the course of his career, would reach virtually every city in America. It would change the face, the mindset, and the culture of U.S. policing from the late 1960s on, through today, and probably into the foreseeable future. He started America's first SWAT team. In September 1953, President Dwight Eisenhower nominated Earl Warren to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He'd later call it one of his greatest mistakes. Warren was a former district attorney, attorney general, and 3-term governor of California. He was also the federal official who oversaw the internment of Japanese Americans in California during World War II. He seemed an unlikely candidate to build a consensus on the court to protect the rights of the accused, which probably made his critics all the angrier when he did. The first major criminal justice decision from the Warren Court was Mapp v. Ohio in 1961. Police in Cleveland suspected that Dollery Mapp had some evidence hidden in her house related to a bombing and a gambling ring. When she refused to let them in, they showed a fake warrant, forced their way inside, and searched her home. They didn't find the evidence they were looking for, but they did find some illegal pornography. She was arrested, charged, and convicted. The police never did produce a search warrant. The court ruled that the Fourth Amendment's protection from unreasonable search and seizures applies to the states through the 14th Amendment, and under the 1914 case Weeks v. United States, evidence seized in an illegal search could not be used at trial. Police in every jurisdiction in the country were now obligated to uphold the Fourth Amendment. The next year, the court found in Robinson v. California that incarcerating someone merely for being addicted to drugs is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. 2 big cases followed in 1963. In Gideon v. Wainwright, the court ruled that states are obligated to pay for an attorney for indigent defendants. And in Brady v. Maryland, it ruled that prosecutors must turn over exculpatory or mitigating evidence to defendants when the evidence is material to guilt or to the defendant's sentence. In 1964, the Warren Court ruled that suspects have the right to an attorney, not just at trial, but during police interrogations as well. The famous Miranda decision came in 1966, which held that police must notify suspects of their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination and to be represented by an attorney. The decision was widely derided by conservatives. It wasn't particularly popular with the general public either. It quickly became a rallying cry for the law and order crowd, who were appalled at the notion that the police could be required to tell suspects that they weren't obligated to answer their questions. The Warren Court's final controversial decision, at least from the law and order side, was Katz versus United States in 1967. In that case, the court expanded the Fourth Amendment's protections from unreasonable search and seizure to the broader standard of a reasonable expectation of privacy. In practical terms, the Fourth Amendment would no longer be limited to physical intrusions. If law enforcement officials wanted to tap a phone, for example, they would need to get a search warrant. Critics of the Warren Court blamed its decisions, at least in part, for the rise in crime that began in the mid-1960s. William F. Buckley called Miranda a venture in abstractionist imperialism and noted that already the reports are coming in from the police commissioners who are, not so quietly, despairing. Conservative columnist James Kilpatrick wrote that the Warren Court was often pleased to turn the Constitution into wax. And it wasn't just conservative intellectuals. The Philadelphia Inquirer wrote after Miranda that it would be a pity, at a time of increased lawlessness, if more attention is given to the rights of lawbreakers than the rights of the public to have effective police protection. The Columbia, South Carolina newspaper The State opined that the court wrapped its flowing robes around all prisoners so as to virtually immunize them from police interrogations. The Richmond Times-Dispatch was blunter still, calling the court an ally of the criminal elements in America. Ironically, the Warren Court's last controversial criminal justice decision actually expanded police authority. Terry v. Ohio was also arguably the decision that would have the most impact on the criminal justice system. In 1968, the court ruled that police officers can stop, detain, and frisk someone based on no more than reasonable suspicion that the person is engaged in criminal activity or about to commit a crime. The vote was 8-1. In the coming years, more conservative Supreme Court lineups would expand the window that the Warren Court created in Terry. Stop and frisk would become a widely used, highly controversial, often abused police tactic. The Warren Court's more controversial decisions are still contentiously debated today. In his book, Breaking Rank, former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper calls the rulings the ones that most often piss off the cops. Current Supreme Court Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas continue to express doubts about both Miranda and the exclusionary rule, which holds that evidence obtained through illegal searches and interrogations can't be used against a defendant at trial. Current Chief Justice John Roberts argued against both for much of his career, and legal pundits have speculated that the court may continue to water down or even overturn one or both during his tenure. But ultimately, Eisenhower's appointment may have served the law and order right better than he could have known before his death in 1969. Although the Warren Court's legacy unquestionably granted new protections to criminal suspects, it also gave conservative politicians a villain to rail against and run against. The court's controversial decisions spurred a generation-long anti-crime backlash that countered its decisions with policies that gave police more power, more discretion, and more authority to use more force. Early in the morning of August 11, 1966, Charles Whitman, an Eagle Scout, an ex-Marine, and a former altar boy, went to his mother's apartment and shot her in the back of the head. He then returned to his own apartment and stabbed his wife to death. He left a note in which he explained that because he loved the two women, he had no choice but to kill them. He wanted to spare them the embarrassment of what was to come. Whitman had been experiencing changes in his behavior for months. He had seen a university psychiatrist, and during a single 2-hour session, confessed that he was having violent impulses with increasing frequency, and felt less and less able to suppress them. Dr. Maurice Dean Heatley described in his notes a man who was oozing with hostility. Whitman relayed a fantasy about going up on the tower with a deer rifle and start shooting people. After killing his wife and mother, Whitman did exactly that. He packed a footlocker with sandwiches, gasoline, 3 rifles, a sawed-off shotgun, 2 handguns, water, and enough ammunition for a day at the shooting range. At around 11 a.m., Whitman rolled the footlocker into an elevator in the clock tower building of the University of Texas at Austin. Posing as a maintenance man, he took the elevator to the 27th floor, just below the clock. There, he met 51-year-old receptionist Edna Townsley and killed her by repeatedly striking her with the butt of a rifle. Whitman hid Townsley's body as 2 visitors came down from the tower, then barricaded the exit. He killed 2 more tourists he found ascending the stairs. Whitman returned to the top of the clock tower and, at about 10 minutes before noon, opened fire on the people below. He shot indiscriminately, but with terrifying precision. A practiced and trained sniper, he fired just 1 bullet at each victim. As the victims fell, bystanders rushed out to help them. Whitman shot at them, too. When ambulances began to arrive, Whitman shot at the drivers. As word got out that there was a shooter in the tower, some peered through windows at the scene unfolding, apparently feeling safe within the walls of a building. He shot them, too. By the time Whitman was shot himself, he had killed 13 people and wounded more than 30, all from a position 230 feet from the ground. One victim, a basketball coach standing in the entrance to a barber shop, was 500 yards away. Whitman's killing spree lasted more than 90 minutes. Austin police didn't have guns that could reach the top of the tower. Some went home to get hunting rifles. Remarkably, a number of students and residents came out with rifles too. At least one witness said that the return fire limited Whitman's options and may have prevented more casualties. For more than an hour and a half, Whitman indiscriminately picked off innocent people while the police were helpless to respond. His guns were bigger than theirs, and he'd positioned himself in a spot they couldn't easily access. Whitman was finally stopped when 3 police officers and a citizen named Alan Crum worked around his barricade and confronted him on the observation platform. Houston McCoy, a 26-year-old Austin police officer, shot Whitman first with a Winchester 12-gauge shotgun. Officer Ramiro Martinez then emptied his revolver into the killer. Whitman was dead. In one of the notes he left behind, Whitman asked that his brain be studied to explain the onset of his violent urges. Doctors found an aggressive brain tumor growing in Whitman's hypothalamus. The tumor was compressing an area of the brain in the hypothalamus known as the amygdala, which regulates primal emotions like fear and anger. Between Whitman's massacre and the epidemic of urban riots, police leaders across the country started to consider whether they were prepared to respond if such incidents happened in their own cities, towns, and counties. The Austin Police Department clearly wasn't prepared, and the incident there created an appetite for precisely the sort of police unit that Darryl Gates was cooking up in Los Angeles. According to author and 25-year police veteran Robert Snow, after Austin, the country's police chiefs knew they couldn't always depend on luck. They needed a unit that could be called in at a moment's notice and plans that could be carried out immediately. In the magazine The Tactical Edge, a publication marketed to SWAT teams, Lieutenant Sid Heal of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department writes that the Whitman shootings marked the birth date of the modern police SWAT concept. Since that day, almost every police department in the United States has formed a special response team to handle similar situations. The riots in Watts and other urban areas may have instilled in Middle America fears of a rising black criminal class, but there was still some sense of safety in the suburbs. Whitman's rampage on a college campus popped that bubble. His victims were college students, administrators, and instructors. The bodies dropping in Austin could have been anyone's kids. Whitman himself was a crew-cut, good-looking ex-Marine. He was married. He played the piano. The shootings made the cover of all the major news magazines. Life ran a photo essay that was as heart-wrenching as it was terrifying. And all of this came as the country was still reeling from Richard Speck's trial for torturing, raping, and murdering 8 nurses at South Chicago Community Hospital a month earlier. The criminal threat no longer seemed to be limited to the inner cities. the victims were no longer urban toughs fighting among themselves. Both the Associated Press and United Press International called Whitman's mass murder the second biggest story of 1966, behind only the Vietnam War. Crime had grabbed America by the lapels. There were a couple other incidents that contributed to Daryl Gates's SWAT vision. At about the same time as the Watts riots, labor strife was heating up the grape farms in Kern County, California. The first major strike began in September 1965, about a month after Watts, when the county's mostly Filipino farm workers were joined by labor activist Cesar Chavez and the group that would become the United Farm Workers. Chavez set up shop in Delano, making the small town in the north of Kern County ground zero for the farm worker labor movement. The Delano grape strike lasted 5 years. The involvement of Chavez and the National Farm Workers Association put the protests in the headlines, sometimes even on state and national television. Given the tumultuous history of labor strikes in the United States, the Delano Police Department looked for measures to keep the strikes from turning violent. The department turned to specialization. Individual Delano officers were given specific training in specialties like crowd control, sniper skills, specialized weapons, riot response, and surveillance. The strike and picketing in Delano never turned violent, though the reason was more likely Chavez's emphasis on pacifism than the sniping skills of Delano cops. Nevertheless, Delano's strategy and its apparent success caught the attention of senior police officials 150 miles down the road in Los Angeles. The second incident came about a month after Watts, when LAPD officer Ron Miller took a late afternoon call about a domestic incident on Surrey Street in northeast Los Angeles. When Miller ascended a set of steps and knocked on the door, 38-year-old Jack Ray Hoxie opened the door and immediately shot him. As Miller attempted to crawl away, another officer, K.A. Ship, pulled up. Hoxie stepped out of the doorway and, with a .30-caliber Winchester, took off part of Ship's ear. As ambulances arrived, a citizen named Billy Richards attempted to help the medical personnel move Miller onto a gurney. Hoxie shot him, too. Eventually, more than 50 police officers showed up, and just about all of them were exchanging gunfire with Hoxie. Gates ordered the house tear-gassed, but as he writes in his autobiography, "By then there were so many holes in the house that the tear gas began spewing out faster than it was going in." Finally, two officers kicked down Hoxie's front door and entered. The gunman was lying wounded in a rear hallway with a rifle and revolver by his side. Officer R.D. Johnson shot him once in the chest, then arrested him. "The incident alarmed me," Gates writes in his book. "Later, as I analyzed how we had responded, I realized again, as I had during Watts, that we were going to have to devise another method for dealing with snipers or barricaded criminals other than our usual indiscriminate shooting." After the Surrey Street shootout, Gates and a small group of LAPD officials began informally consulting with Marines stationed at the Naval Armory in Chavez Ravine. The group included Jeff Rogers, who would later lead the country's first SWAT team, and Sergeant John Nelson, often credited along with Gates with inventing the SWAT idea. Nelson became a self-taught expert in guerrilla warfare. The informal project wasn't sanctioned by the LAPD. In fact, when Gates first broached the idea of an elite police team for incidents like Watts and Surrey Street, he was rebuffed. The Parker administration had little interest, but Gates, Nelson, and Rogers kept at it. They scoured the department for its best sharpshooters and put them on the shooting range for more training during off hours. They also brought in military personnel to teach strategies for handling snipers. At an awards banquet held in July 1966, Los Angeles Police Chief William Parker died of an aneurysm shortly after accepting an honor from a group for military veterans. New Chief Thomas Redden would serve only until May 1969, but his short tenure had a lasting impact on the career of Daryl Gates and the future of SWAT. Shortly after Redden took over, the LAPD faced a public crisis after officers clashed with anti-war protesters and bystanders in Century City. President Lyndon Johnson had been scheduled to give a public address, so the clashes, in which police were seen clubbing protesters and onlookers and ramming them with motorcycles, received national attention. In response, Redden created a new unit called Tactical Operations Planning. The unit's mission was to plan for and respond to big events such as riots, protests, and visits from dignitaries. Redden put the new unit in the city's Metropolitan Division, an elite roving unit of officers given broad authority to suppress criminal activity. The Metro Division's propensity for controversy had earned it the nickname the Shake, Rattle, and Roll Boys. Their charge from Redden: roust anything strange that moves on the streets. The new unit expanded Metro from 55 to 220 officers. Redden put Gates in charge. Gates's first task was to respond to a rash of robberies on the city's buses. Needing personnel, Gates asked other divisions across the city to send him officers. According to Gates's autobiography, "Most of the divisions sent me the least desirable people they had." But the new crew put an end to the bus robberies, earning itself and Gates some added credibility with Redden. Defying the organizational structure used in the rest of the department, Gates explains in his autobiography that he broke his new unit down into 16 military-type squads. He then combined the squads into two platoons, adding yet more war terminology to the environment around him and the officers he worked with. Gates was eventually able to get the 60 marksmen he had been working with across the department reassigned to Metro. Now staffed with top-notch, highly skilled cops, Gates mixed the marksmen with his best men from tactical operations planning. He then broke the unit down into five-man teams: a leader, a marksman, an observer, a scout, and a rear guard. Two teams together made up a squad. They were called D-Platoon, somewhat confusingly, since there were only three platoons at the time. But Gates wasn't fond of D-Platoon. He had a different name in mind, from his autobiography. "One day, with a big smile on my face, I popped in to tell my deputy chief, Ed Davis, that I thought up an acronym for my special new unit. He was still, as we all were, glued to the classic concepts of policing, which discouraged the formation of military-type units. But he realized some changes would have to be made. 'It's SWAT,' I said. 'Oh, that's pretty good. What's it stand for?' 'Special Weapons Attack Teams.' Davis blinked at me. 'No.' There was no way, he said dismissively, he would ever use the word attack. I went out, crestfallen, but a moment later I was back. 'Special Weapons and Tactics,' I said. 'Okay?' 'No problem, that's fine,' Davis said. And that was how SWAT was born." Gates still had some work ahead of him to win over his superiors. That SWAT operates like a quasi-militaristic operation offended some of the brass, he writes. So D-Platoon trained in secret on some city-owned farmland in the San Fernando Valley. They also began working directly with Marine units at Camp Pendleton in San Diego County, with some help from Universal Studios. The movie company let the Abecedarian recruits hone their special forces skills on the replica storefronts, buildings, and houses on its back lot in Burbank. Within a couple of years, Gates's SWAT team would forge its place in history during a televised shootout that made national news. But Gates clearly never got over the lack of support during the project's early years. Of course, that reticence stemmed from a healthy appreciation for the symbolic Third Amendment that Gates clearly didn't share, or at least didn't think was threatened by cops who trained with and operated like soldiers. Despite the new unit's record and reputation, officials balked at police using fully automatic weapons. The standard cry was, "Hey, the LAPD is supposed to be a civil police force. Their job is to relate to the community, not put on combat boots and assault the community. For years, we tried to assure everyone that, yes, we are a civil police force. The people are the police, and the police are the people, and we hold to that. Though at times, assault is not a dirty word. For the types of situations Gates had in mind, the Watts riots, the Surrey Street barricade, the Texas Clock Tower massacre, he was right. Assault wasn't a dirty word. It was an appropriately swift, forceful response to defuse a violent situation. As the domestic strife dragged on, other police departments began to see things the way Gates did. In March 1968, the Associated Press conducted a national survey and found that, in city after city across America, the police are stockpiling armored vehicles, helicopters, and high-powered rifles. They are preparing for summer and the riots they hope will not occur. In Gates's Los Angeles, the AP reported, police watched a demonstration in which a 20-ton armored personnel carrier crushed a barricade of abandoned cars. Tampa Police Chief James G. Littleton told the news agency that his department had taken off the kid gloves. He had just purchased 162 shotguns, 150 bayonets, 5 sniper rifles, 25 carbines and M1 rifles, and 200 gas masks. Florida State Attorney Paul Antoneri told the AP that he had instructed police officers to shoot to kill if they spotted anyone committing or about to commit a felony. A spokesman for the New Jersey State Police told the AP, "We're following through on the military concept in attacking this problem." This was an understandable response to the growing sense that American cities were spilling over with crime, violence, and rioting, and indeed, starting the month after the AP article was published, 1968 would unfold as one of the most turbulent years of the 20th century. But when the riots, strife, and unrest finally died down, when the threat of chaos and lawlessness eventually grew remote, the weapons, heavy-duty vehicles, and militaristic culture stuck around. Gates's original intent for the SWAT concept may have been appropriate, but as SWAT teams swelled in number, mission, and frequency of use over the next 40 years, Gates not only never spoke out against the trend, but took pride in it and actively encouraged it. By the mid-1960s, the pieces were falling into place to make disorder a national political issue. The crime rate was climbing. High-profile incidents, like Whitman's mass shooting, had shocked the country. Riots had white America terrified of the cities. All that needed to happen was for a savvy politician to run with the issue. In an April 1965 Gallup poll, more than half the country cited race relations as their number one concern, the first time in 8 months that a domestic issue topped the poll. Columnists and media outlets on the right were taking shots at the Supreme Court's criminal-friendly decisions, as well as President Johnson's failure to address crime with adequately tough measures. Johnson also watched the polls closely. The New York Times wrote in 1966 that the president appears to retain an almost psychological need for public approval, and was well aware that his approval ratings had started to sag, a long, slow decline starting in the spring of 1965. Johnson attempted to co-opt some of his critics' momentum by adopting the crime issue himself. He first turned to a Washington, D.C. perennial, the Blue Ribbon Commission. He announced the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice. His Attorney General, Nicholas Katzenbach, would chair it. Its laughably lofty mission, to draw up the blueprints that we need for effective action to banish crime. The resulting report, The Challenge of Crime in a Free Society, included over 200 recommendations to fight crime, from establishing a national phone number for emergencies, the precursor to 911, to decriminalizing drug abuse and public drunkenness. But Johnson's critics seized on the more platitudinous and abstract recommendations. The commission asserted that ending poverty would be the single most important crime-fighting initiative, and recommended minority outreach bureaus within major police departments, the establishment of multiple crime and justice research institutions, family planning assistance, recommitting to desegregation, funding for drug abuse treatment, and gun control. To Johnson's critics, this was just more leftist, mealy-mouthed academies. There was lots of government spending. The commission didn't bother to estimate a price tag for its recommendations. Plenty of lofty talk about social uplift and hand-wringing about the influence on crime of environmental factors, all of which rather conveniently aligned with Johnson's other domestic policies. But there was precious little in the way of taking it hard to the bad guys. For a war on crime, there wasn't nearly enough fighting. Johnson responded by making the federal government more proactive in fighting the drug trade. He created the first major federal agency specifically tasked with enforcing the federal drug laws, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, BNDD, which would later become the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, combined smaller agencies in the Treasury and the Health, Education, and Welfare Departments into one office that would operate within the Department of Justice. Johnson also expanded the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance into the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEAA, the first federal agency created to stream federal funding, equipment, and technology directly to state and local law enforcement agencies. The United States had long taken a federalist approach to law enforcement. Except for offenses involving the mail, bank robbers, and crossing those state borders, the power to make crime policy had been reserved to the states. Johnson's successors would quickly discover that introducing a funding spigot like LEAA, then threatening to pull it away, was an effective way to persuade local police agencies to adopt their preferred policies. Johnson's efforts didn't quell his critics. His attorney general, Ramsey Clark, was widely seen on the right as the walking embodiment of the root causes, soft-on-criminals approach to criminal justice policy. In an interview for this book, Donald Santarelli, a young but influential aide to Nixon's 1968 campaign, said that Nixon would often tell Republican supporters that his administration would have an attorney general, a bit of signaling that to law and order conservatives, needed no further explanation. Before the 1968 presidential campaign kicked off, the 31-year-old Santarelli had been the minority counsel on the House Judiciary Committee. In the summer of 1967, he and other House Republicans decided to put together a crime bill that would address, a critic might say exploit, public reaction to the rioting and high-profile shootings. There was an increasing fear of crime, Santarelli says, and at the same time, you had the rise of the civil rights movement, the riots, the Black Panthers, and this increase in drug use. I think the public started to pick up on the idea that these things were linked because they were all happening simultaneously. The Republicans put together a bill with a host of new anti-crime, anti-drug measures, including a provision to authorize wiretapping, and another that weakened the Miranda warning. Law enforcement is just like any other interest group, Santarelli says. They're always after greater power. There was a sense that they needed to capitalize on these historic events, and I think there was a real willingness on the part of the public to give them whatever powers they sought. There were two other controversial provisions in the original 1968 crime bill. The first would have dramatically changed the bail system, by effectively doing away with it completely. The burden would have been shifted to defendants to show that they didn't pose a threat to the public or a flight risk. If they could do so, they'd be released. If they couldn't, they'd be held until trial. Both supporters and detractors dubbed it preventive detention, a term that served both sides. For conservatives, it sounded like the sort of rigorous lock-em-up policy that would play well in the election. For liberals, preventive detention was the sort of term used in a police state. Santarelli stands by the initiative to this day and insists that it was portrayed unfairly. This was about equity, he insists. The risk of flight and the seriousness of the crime are factors in who gets held before trial today. But the primary factor is money. If you can't make bail, you stay in jail. That's incredibly unfair. We wanted to take wealth out of the equation. The other provision was the no-knock raid. Despite the fact that the 1964 Rockefeller Law was barely used in New York, other states had since passed similar measures. The law and order right had run with the concept as a litmus test, tough-on-crime measure. The exigent circumstances exceptions to knock and announce had been pretty well established by that time, Santarelli says. I didn't intend for a no-knock to be a political weapon, but it became one. The Republican crime bill passed relatively easily in the summer of 1968 with little opposition from Democrats. The no-knock raid and preventive detention measures didn't make the bill's final draft, but both ideas would return, and soon. At 6:01 p.m. on April 4, 1968, just as Martin Luther King Jr. stepped out onto a balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, James Earl Ray fired a single 30-caliber bullet from the Remington rifle he'd perched on the bathroom window of a boarding house across the street. King was dead. Within hours, more than 100 American cities broke out in rioting. The riots reinforced in white middle-class America the sense that American cities had become zones of lawlessness. And again, it was black people causing all the violence. In fact, it came at a time when much of that same white middle-class America began to sense that its values and traditions were under attack from all sides. In his drug war history, Smoke and Mirrors, journalist Dan Baum points out that black homicide arrests doubled between 1960 and 1967. At the same time, heroin deaths and overdoses were also on the rise. The hippie, anti-war, and counterculture movements were in full swing. All of this also coincided with the rise of the civil rights movement. Nixon's silent majority began to see a link between drugs, crime, the counterculture, and race. The movements had some common elements, but there was little evidence that drug use was causing the spike in violent crime. For example, while it was true that heroin junkies were more likely to commit crimes like burglary and theft to support their habit, it wasn't true that drug use was causing the surge in violent crime. A 1971 study from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the government's anti-drug enforcement arm itself, found that illicit drug users were 35% less likely to be arrested and charged with homicide than non-drug users, and less than half as likely to be charged with aggravated assault. The rise in pot smoking among the counterculture was even less threatening, and less of a contributor to the crime rate. But candidate Nixon and his politically savvy advisors seized on the growing assumption in middle America that all of these things were connected. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated in April 1968, the party used his death to push its crime bill, even though his assassination would prove to have been politically motivated, and Kennedy himself had been opposed to the more controversial parts of the law. Months later, at the 1968 Democratic National Convention, DNC, police in Chicago would instigate a riot, then indiscriminately beat liberal protesters. Some of the beatings were aired live by the networks covering the convention. Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff was nominating George McGovern to be the party's candidate during one clash between police and protesters. Ribicoff strayed from the script in his nominating speech to proclaim, "With George McGovern, we wouldn't have Gestapo tactics on the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have a National Guard." Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, who had called up more than 20,000 police and National Guard troops for the convention, didn't do much to distance himself from the Nazi smear. Lip readers later alleged he shouted up from the convention floor, "Fuck you, you Jew son of a bitch! You lousy motherfucker, go home!" Nixon's ignored Americans weren't the least bit troubled by what they saw from Daley and the police. According to a Gallup poll taken a few weeks later, 56% of the country supported the crackdown and just 31% were opposed. Polls would also show Nixon surging into a comfortable lead over the eventual Democratic nominee, Hubert Humphrey. In 1969, Newsweek commissioned its own Gallup poll for a cover story headlined, "The Troubled American, a Special Report on the White Majority." its findings. 85% of whites thought that black militants were getting off too easily. 65% thought that unemployed blacks were more likely to get government aid than unemployed whites. And 66% thought that the police needed to be given more power. Nearly half thought that the country had moved backward over the last 10 years, and nearly 60% thought that things were only going to get worse. Crime, race, hippies, anti-war protesters. Nixon's strategists needed a way to draw all of the concerns of his silent majority together. As Baum explains, they found their answer with drugs. Nixon looked at his people and found them quaking with rage and fear, not at Vietnam, but at the unholy amalgam of stoned hippies, brawless women, homicidal Negroes, larcenous junkies, and treasonous priests. Nixon's genius was in hammering these images together into a rhetorical sword. People steal, burn, and use drugs not because of root causes, but because they are bad people. They should be punished, not coddled. Another poll taken just weeks before the election showed the power of television. While a majority of Americans feared the country was headed toward anarchy, just 28% felt that crime had gone up in their own communities. Most Americans felt perfectly safe walking in their own neighborhoods, but assumed most of their fellow citizens didn't feel the same way. As he slogged through the primaries in early 1968, Nixon was well aware of this. "People don't have to experience crime firsthand to feel threatened by it," he wrote to his old friend and mentor, Dwight Eisenhower. "I have found great audience response to this law and order theme in all parts of the country, including areas like New Hampshire, where there is virtually no race problem and relatively little crime." Shortly before the 1968 election, Nixon called illicit drugs the modern curse of the youth, just like the plagues and epidemics of former years. "And they are decimating a generation of Americans." He wouldn't explicitly declare war on drugs for another few years, but his rhetoric was already slipping into combat fatigues. The Law and Order campaign worked. Nixon won the 1968 election by a comfortable margin in the Electoral College. And when you factor in the votes for George Wallace, Humphrey lost the popular vote by a wide margin. The Republicans also picked up 5 seats in the Senate and 5 in the House. In 4 years, crime had become the most important issue in the country. The new administration wasted little time. The White House point man on crime would be Edgell Krogh, a 29-year-old family friend of Nixon aide John Ehrlichman. Though just out of law school, Krogh would make crime policy for the entire country. In 1968, before Nixon had yet been inaugurated, Krogh and Ehrlichman had a strategy session with Nebraska Senator Roman Hruska, the ranking minority member on the Judiciary Committee. Hruska had an idea to assemble a crime bill just for the District of Columbia. Congress had jurisdiction over the city, making it an ideal spot to test out new ideas without worrying about encroaching on the traditional federalist approach to crime. D.C. at the time wasn't any more dangerous than other large cities. But less than a year had gone by since the riots after the death of Martin Luther King, and there was at least the perception that the city was uniquely dangerous, especially for muggings and robberies. At the top of Hruska's wish list for D.C. were the preventive detention and no-knock raid provisions that had been cut out of the crime bill passed 6 months earlier. Krogh took Hruska's idea to John Mitchell, Nixon's nominee for attorney general. Mitchell had run Nixon's law and order-themed campaign, so it was natural for the president-elect to select his good friend to run the Justice Department. A former semi-pro hockey player, Mitchell had commanded a PT boat during World War II. Coincidentally, his lieutenant was John F. Kennedy. After the war, he became a successful, self-made municipal bond lawyer. Mitchell was exposed to the power of law and order issues while serving as a bond counsel for the Rockefeller administration in New York. He and Nixon became friends when their law firms merged in 1967. John Mitchell would be the public face of Nixon's crime policy. The new administration held two big strategy sessions on crime, one just before Nixon took office and another shortly after his inauguration. Also attending these meetings, in addition to Krogh,